Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock. This week, Union Strong talks with a flight attendant who's lost coworkers to the COVID-19 pandemic and says,
the main message is don't fly right now.
And on the labor segment of Willamette Wake Up, Andrea Haverkamp of the Coalition of Graduate Employees at Oregon State University explains why grad students are workers.
We are researchers. We are teachers. We develop courses. We are the real lifeblood of the modern university system.
That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Union Strong is the official podcast of the New York State AFL-CIO, sharing stories of working men and women who benefit from belonging to a union and having a voice in the workplace. Here's Darcy Wells with an excerpt from this week's show.
Among the workers on the front line during this health crisis are our brothers and sisters who are transporting other essential workers to and from their jobs. They are members of the Transport Workers Union. They're testing positive to the coronavirus in staggering numbers. And even more alarming is how many have died. For the New York State AFL-CIO, I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong. TWU members are responsible for getting the doctors and nurses, police officers, and other critical workers safely to and from their jobs in and around New York City. Other TWU members, including flight attendants and those on Amtrak, are also putting their own lives at risk to get people from point A to point B, regardless of the reason or actual need. On this podcast, we hear from a flight attendant, an Amtrak service worker, a member who works for the subway division in New York City, and John Samuelson, the international president of the Transport Workers Union, representing more than 150,000 members. First, what's going on in the airline industry? On the phone with me now is a member of TWU, a flight attendant based at JFK for a major airline, and we're going to refer to her as Jane because we need to protect her identity because there's some concerns, unfortunately, about speaking out. So, Jane, thank you for being on the podcast.
Absolutely.
How are you doing yourself? Are you healthy?
I am. I'm healthy, yes.
Good.
Knock on wood.
Good. So, Jane, talk to us a little bit about what you're up against as a flight attendant. What are the risks that you're dealing with on a daily basis, and what has your work environment been like throughout this health crisis?
Well, on a daily basis, flight attendants in general, pandemic or no pandemic, are always in a cesspool of just dirtiness. People regularly hand you their used facial tissue in your bare hand. It's just normal. You're walking through the cabin and they're handing you all kinds of stuff. It isn't until recently, in the last 2 weeks, actually, because our union put pressure, TWU put pressure on our management to allow us to wear masks and gloves during all phases of flight, that we feel at least a little bit more protected. But it almost happened a bit too late because we've had casualties. We've had 4 coworkers that have died as a result of the coronavirus. So what's happening now isn't really that much different than what we normally deal with, in that the planes are trashed always. You would think that because people have some education on what not to leave behind, that they would, but that's not the case. So they leave behind their used gloves, their used masks, their disinfectant wipes, and we're supposed to pick them up for them. We still have to clean the plane after every flight. So, I mean, naturally, you can assume how we're, you know, being presented with all kinds of contaminants, you know.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. So I'm wondering, when this first came about, when we started all realizing how serious that this was, the coronavirus, and you know, explaining how you're taking, you know, use things from people on a regular basis, was it pretty immediate that you folks started realizing, well, wait a minute, we've got to do things differently?
Actually, you know, at the beginning, I don't know if it is because the company played it down, or I really don't know what the case was. We weren't as nervous at first, but I think also because we weren't being told, listen, this is what's going on, you know? Mm-hmm. And as it became something that wasn't going away, then you really did start to think to yourself, oh my gosh, this is a lot worse than we all thought. So we started to really fear for our lives because we have such close contact with people, you know?
Right. And you've got people coming in and out from all different areas and you have no idea what they're bringing on board with
them.
Well,
actually, that's a problem right now because we have have certain borders closed, right, where the Americans aren't allowed into certain countries. However, those people are allowed to come back. So we're flying empty planes to those countries, and then people who aren't being tested and are walking around in certain countries where they only get fined $30 if they're going to a restaurant or whatnot, they're coming back on our planes and we're bringing them into the United States. So we're propagating this pandemic.
Right. So that's, yeah, that's distressing in its own right. I'm sure dealing with the fact that you've lost 4 coworkers, mm-hmm. Are you angry? Are you angry at the company for not doing more? I mean, do you feel this could have been prevented? I mean, what are those emotions that you're feeling?
Oh, I'm going to cry. Well, yes, deep sadness that I've lost people that I know and love and work with. But also, yes, I feel that a lot of this could have been prevented with precautionary measures. Our union is constantly having to request or implore, I should say, better safeguards for our health. I mean, we only started wearing masks 2 weeks ago, for God's sake.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And on top of that, they had to meet certain requirements. They had to be certain colors. They had to be this, that, the other thing. Now, only recently are we allowed to wear whatever we can find. And it really is whatever we can find because they're not supplying them either. So that's another problem. But yeah, the whole thing is very distressing. I'm distressed that we have flight attendants who are of an age where if they could, they really should not be working, but they can't take the voluntary leave because they don't have the seniority to be able to do so. And partly because we've got supervisors who are taking the leave instead and they trump them in seniority. So that's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you go into a supervisor's office and there's this big rope barricade separating you from them. So clearly they understand the gravity of the situation, but they don't apply it to the aircraft. We've got aircraft scheduled to go out in May with up to 100 passengers on the plane. Now, I can tell you that there is no airline that has that much legroom. So clearly they're not meeting the social distance guidelines.
So how does that work? I mean,
how does it work? They're just doing it. And on top of that, they're offering fares to people to make it desirable to fly. So you could go pretty much anywhere round trip for $20 right now. And I can tell you that the same people that are taking advantage of these low fares to get wherever they want to go enjoy themselves are clearly not taking this as seriously as we are. So you can imagine that they don't care about their health. They're not going to care about yours. So those are the people that leave all their gloves and masks and doodads behind.
So you can't tell or force the passengers to wear protective gear?
No, not only that, we do not have a general public announcement that we say. Like,
oh my God,
go into some grocery stores today and they are constantly piping out their public announcements saying, this is what we're doing. You're going to line up here. You're going to keep a social distance between you. None of that on the airplane. Nothing.
What do you have for?
We can't actually make unscripted public announcements.
That's just insane. What do you have for PPE right now?
What do we have for what?
For PPE, the protective equipment, the protective personal equipment.
Well, basically just masks and gloves. I mean, you mean other than things that are on board generally, like oxygen, those kinds of things?
Well, no, I'm thinking with what you've just described that you should be like in a full body suit.
Oh, yeah. I know. I know. That's actually, I think that would make me feel safer. No, just a glove, just gloves and masks. That's it.
So what
in fact, we're supposed to actually take the mask off in order to make those public announcements that don't require people to do anything special.
Oh my gosh.
And we're also supposed to not wear them during our safety demonstration.
What would be your, I mean, I don't know how many people might be listening that I actually will get on an airplane, but if, what do you want them to know? I mean, you know, what's your message to them in order to keep you guys safe?
Well, I think the main message is don't fly right now. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, like to the general public, just don't fly. Nothing is that important where you have to get from point A to point B. And if you do, then you've got to respect the other people around you, including the people working for you as human beings. Mm-hmm. I don't think people think of flight attendants as human beings, but particularly now, you know, it's important. It's, you know, even in the food store, these poor essential workers that are working there, they're trying to maneuver people into separate lines or whatever, and they get attitude for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no humanity even now in the face of a pandemic. And I feel that there is no human component at our job right now. They're not taking into consideration how unsafe this is to book the flights up to 100 people. It's insane to me.
Yeah, it sure sounds it. And Jane, and again, not your real name, but Jane, when you go home, what is that stress like? Like, what do you do to prepare yourself to then go into your own home to your family?
It's super stressful. I have to basically strip down at the door because I don't want to bring anything that has been contaminated on the aircraft into my home, my shoes, my whole uniform, just leave it there, throw it in a bag, and then, you know, wash it. I have to do the same thing for my husband, who's a first responder, and that's difficult. We have two little kids that we're both responsible for. Imagine if we both get sick.
No, I can't. Right.
So there's that. I can't even imagine what it's like for people who aren't awarded the time off if they don't have the seniority to do so and have a similar situation where they have a sick person at home that they have to care for. Now the kids are home from school, so there's got to be somebody around. And if you're not senior enough to do that, then, oh, well, too bad for you. They should at least allow the flight attendants to stay home without any disciplinary action. And that's not happening right now.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you for being so, you know, open and willing to share what you're dealing with. I think it's really important for people to understand and maybe it will help change some attitudes, like you said, to, you know, stop flying right now. We hope that you are able to stay safe and stay healthy, and same to your family as well. And thank you very much for what you're doing every day throughout this. We really, really want to thank you and we appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for letting me express my thoughts.
Okay. You take care.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the Union Strong podcast. If you like what you're hearing, you can subscribe and give us a rating. This has been a production of the New York State AFL-CIO. Our president is Mario Salento. Our secretary treasurer is Terry Melvin. We're a federation of 3,000 unions representing 2.5 million union members, retirees, and their families with one goal: to raise the standard of living and quality of life of all working people. We keep New York State Union strong by fighting for better wages, better benefits, and better working conditions. For more information on the labor movement in New York, visit NYSAFLCIO.org. Until next time, stay union and stay strong.
Bob Rossi hosts a regular labor segment on the Willamette Wake Up program airing on Salem, Oregon's KMUZ. Here's Bob with an excerpt from a recent show.
Good morning, KMUZ listeners, and welcome to another KMUZ Labor Radio segment. We want to thank the Marion Polk Yamhill Labor Chapter and the many unions and union members who support this station and this show. Please attend your union meetings. And if you're in the Kaiser-Salem area, please show up at the Labor Chapter meetings as well. We've covered graduate student employee union organizing on this show previously, but graduate employee organizing has not stopped. Recently, a movement of graduate workers met some stiff pushback at the University of California at Santa Cruz. I think that 50 workers were fired, and those firings provoked a number of wildcat strikes through the system. And at the time that we're recording this, campus labor in California has been successful in winning health coverage for those workers, despite the dismissals. Now we need those union members returned to work and made whole. This has been an inspiring movement. Here to talk to us today from the front lines of graduate worker organizing is Andrea Haverkamp. Andrea is a PhD candidate in environmental engineering at Oregon State University. Her research has centered on supporting gender-diverse students in undergraduate engineering education. She's on the editorial board of the International Journal of Engineering, Social Justice, and Peace. She also worked at the U.S. Air Force and the EPA, and she was a Peace Corps volunteer. She has an interesting blog at sjengineers.blog. Best of all for me, Andrea and the Coalition of Graduate Employees Union at OSU give us in the labor movement hope in dark times. I'm looking forward to a great conversation today. Sister Andrea Haverkamp, how are you today?
I'm doing good. I'm feeling excited and energized by everything that is happening right now, from labor organizing to grassroots organizing that's happened with all workers in this crisis. How are you doing today?
Well, we're wearing masks down here, and it's a little hard to breathe, but I'm learning. Well, let's drive right in. So who exactly are graduate employees, and what is the Coalition of Graduate Employees, CGE, at OSU?
So the first question, what exactly are graduate employees? Graduate employees are workers. We are researchers. We are teachers. We develop courses. We are the real lifeblood of the modern university system as far as workers go. We work in exchange for a paycheck, and as part of our compensation, our tuition and fees are remitted. So we spend part of our time working and part of our time taking classes and writing. And a lot of times it's kind of a chicken or an egg situation because, you know, as to what's what, because they're so intimately tied. So my research is my employment, is my dissertation. And the Coalition of Graduate Employees is a AFT, American Federation of Teachers, local chapter here in Oregon, 6069. And we are a labor union celebrating 20 years of organizing here at this campus. When we started 20 years ago, when we were first recognized right at the turn of the decade, we did not have healthcare and we did not have tuition remission. Right now, we have fought over decades for a wage that's closer to a living wage, healthcare coverage for us and our families, and full tuition remission and most of our fees remitted if we are graduate students who are also graduate employees. So we are a robust 1,800 member union. That's 1,800 people who make this university run. And we are adamant that we are employees over students.
Well, that's quite a bit there. Now, back in March, I attended a rally at OSU that was called by CGE. Can you tell our listeners what that was about and what happened there?
Yeah, so in March, it feels like ancient history at the beginning of March, how fast time has flown. But we gathered about 200 people there for a rally supporting a petition that our union members have put together calling for a cut in the pay of the highest paid administrators at this institution and for that funds to be redirected towards the things they say they can't afford. They are able to afford to pay the president $750,000 a year on top of other benefits, but they claim to be unable to help us with housing or with hardship funds or in increases to our wages. In fact, they're offering us a pay cut this year in our newest contract cycle. So about 200 of us gathered there outside of the president's office in the administration building. We were all discussing and talking and asking them to come down and address the crowd as to whether or not they can justify their pay. And what happened there was the president of the university, Ed Ray, came down and immediately tried to steer this as if we were talking about the current bargaining session. But it is not. We reminded him over and over again, we're talking about the petition. Would you be willing to cut your salary down to $186,000? Which I think, I don't know about you, but I find that quite reasonable to make $186,000 a year. and to use those excess funds to help the struggling mothers who are employees, the families with children who need them. You know, we have employees who are sleeping in cars. You know, $15,000 a year doesn't go very far. But, you know, if you cut about $500,000 off your salary, you could help us out, is what we were saying. And he really decided to be very dismissive and try to change the subject before himself getting frustrated and going up. And I think we were all very energized, you know, 200 people being able to see not only that we are united, but that we think we are on the right side of this fight.
Well, I want to underscore the power dynamics there for a minute for our listeners. So graduate workers are what people used to call graduate students. I think that's right. And to follow this question about the power dynamic along the line, how does somebody get to be a graduate employee? How does that happen?
So for you to be a graduate employee, there's already so many barriers, right? You have to often, first of all, be admitted to the graduate school to begin with. There's something that everyone says to each other, whether it's online or in person, don't go to graduate school if they're not paying you. So the vast, vast, vast majority of graduate students are workers and are employees, are compensated in some ways, you know, because a lot of us are in our 30s. You know, we need a job and we are often paid to do the same work a professor does at a much lower pay, or the same work that an instructor or a researcher does at a much lower pay. As part of, you know, quote unquote, our education, we are sort of shadowing other people and learning how to do research and teach. And so to first become that graduate student, to be a student worker, you have to apply to these jobs. Essentially, is what applying to graduate school is applying to a job. So everything that goes into it, writing letters, getting recommendations, putting together your resume on top of standardized test scores, that's how you begin a worker. Is it's you almost get them both at the same time, your job offer and your admittance letter to a university.
So that's a boss-worker relationship right there that you're describing. When you're talking to President Ray at that rally, I really want our listeners to understand that dynamic as we go through this. And there y'all were out there talking to the boss, and he backed down. Now, I've heard you make an interesting point that this process of becoming a graduate employee is like an apprenticeship. That's an interesting point. Now, in our union apprenticeships, a person is getting a union wage when they work. They aren't paying for their job, and they come out with no debt. But that isn't the situation in higher ed, is it?
No, it's not quite the situation. It's so similar to how it should be working, but that ain't really the deal we're getting. We are getting paid far lower than everyone else. Many of us still come out with debt because I don't know if you've ever tried to, a lot of people are trying to raise a family off of $15,000 a year when one person is the graduate employee. So a lot of people still incur debt, as a lot of people who live in poverty are. And our union is fighting tooth and nail for us to get a raise, but Oregon State University seems adamantly against it. And our work relations, it isn't so much to try to welcome us into the ranks of the few hundred faculty versus nearly 2,000 graduate employees. It's not an equal relationship. There's usually about one job opening in this field for every 100 PhD graduates. So at the end of my 5 years of employment here, half a decade spent as a graduate employee, I will leave with a PhD. And as opposed to an apprenticeship, there's very little avenue for me to continue on, whereas my bosses throughout the way have benefited tremendously from me doing the same work as a lot of them.
That's fundamental. Thank you for explaining that. Now, I heard a few things at that rally that I also want to explore with you here. Y'all did a petition, and I heard some talk about the 99% versus the 1%. And I even heard some talk about wage disparities and wage cuts and getting a maximum wage. Now, I believe this is new ground for many of our listeners. Can you take us through some of that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So where we started off with in our petition was thinking about how the university always says they don't have money to give us raises, or they just don't have the money to give some of our lowest paid coworkers more hours. And they just never seem to have the money. Well, if you just look at publicly available salary tables that you'll find, if you Google Oregon State University unclassified salaries, these are the administrators' salaries. And we could see where the money's hiding. The money is hiding in roughly 125 individuals who make an average of about $350,000 a year. Some of these people, you know, once you get into $500,000 or more a year, which there are dozens, those are members of the top 1% of income earners. And these are the people who are saying that they don't have money to give us an extra $30 a month paycheck. You know, our 6% raise that we're seeking this next year, you know, that amounts to an extra $30 to $50 a month. Some of these people make in 1 month what us, essentially their coworkers, make in an entire year. So we started off with that, just looking at the math and saying, well, does anyone need to be paid over $500,000 a year at a public university? And what would a fair wage be? So we thought, what if the top wage at a public university was twice of what the governor of Oregon makes? The governor of Oregon, you can Google it too, Kate Brown, makes about $98,000 a year. You know, we don't think it's too ridiculous that if you are just an administrator looking over part of a school, not even the whole school, part of a school, that you could be paid double what the governor makes. And then we showed through just the math from this publicly available information that $8.7 million could be raised, could be freed up, could be used to help the most vulnerable in our workforce if you just put a maximum salary. The idea is that you chop from the top to build from the bottom. So that's what we called our petition, the Chop from the Top petition. We received over 1,300 signatures. And we think the math speaks for itself, and I think that's why it resonates, is that putting a cap on salaries would allow for a freeze in tuition for us and our undergraduates. It would allow $8.7 million to be spent towards affordable housing for increases in compensation for all non-managerial staff, faculty, and adjuncts. It would allow us guaranteed summer funding because a lot of my other coworkers who are graduate employees are only paid 9 months out of the year. Their quality of life drastically decreases in the summer. So those were our demands. This is the third administrator we've brought this proposal to who has outright dismissed it, pretended not to read it, and move on. But they've read it. They're just afraid of where their millions would go if this were to happen.
Well, there are some interesting social principles there, and if they're not paying attention, that's too bad. Some of us think back to Occupy or the Occupy movement when we hear this talk about the 99% and the 1%. I didn't go to college, so I had to think for a minute how that works out exactly on a campus. We've all heard about Phil Knight influencing higher ed, but there are other influences at work as well, aren't there? And it seems to me that there are other corporate influences, or influencers, I should say, as well, and that the system is geared more to producing something like a value than it is to teaching and learning. How do we get to that point?
You know, that is the question I think that should be on top of everything. How did we get to this point? You're right. It is working to be producing something. It is acting like a private business rather than actually teaching and learning. If you look at where the salaries are going, it's all going towards administration and athletics. When aren't we supposed to be teaching? How come the bulk of that income, that money that's coming in, isn't being spent on teachers and learning? And it's being spent on these wealthy financiers. How do we get to this point? Part of it comes from decades and decades of austerity measures that have slashed state funding for higher education, combined with this new model of treating the less money it takes from the state, the more public universities take it from tuition. And then they start operating like a business. How can we raise tuition to get more money, to build a new building, to bring in more students, to raise even more tuition? I went to a budget meeting recently, as they are open to anyone at Oregon State University. They're very dry, but you can go in there and you can see that not only has funding from the state of Oregon increased the past few years, but tuition has increased every year the past few years. The universities are making money on constantly growing their enrollment, growing online outreach, online courses. You know, Oregon State University started a campus in Bend. It's a constant growth model to produce degrees, pieces of paper, on increasingly more expensive tuition. And how do we get to that point? Well, you look at the leadership. Oregon State University has a board of trustees. It is not democratic and it is not representative. Out of all the trustees, only one person has had any experience as a faculty member or a teacher. It is full of wealthy financiers from Nike, from Intel, people who are out of the banking industry. It is a, I don't even know what a good word for it is. It's a big collection of people, and I'm not going to name names or be specific on here, but if you look at the public information on who's on that board of trustees and you kind of look at their LinkedIn profiles and where they've worked, you can see that it is clearly being run for essentially shareholder interests.
Well, is there an ask for our listeners and for our unions here? What do you need us to take away from all of this?
If you Google CHOP from the top, Oregon State University, that will take you to our petition, which online has 763 signatures, and in person we have another 500 signatures or so. And that talks about our cuts at salaries at $186,000 a year, and it would show some solidarity. And that's about all I can ask. My main ask also for listeners is to stay home, stay healthy, and stay safe.
And while they're staying home, they can look at your blog, which I really like and learn from. Can you give us the address again?
Yeah, that is SJ Engineers, stands for Social Justice Engineers.blog. And then our union website, if you want to see some of what our exciting little union is up to, is CGE6069.org.
We got to wrap this up. I want to thank you, Andrea Haverkamp, for visiting with us today. I hope that we can get some reports from you back in the future, and I wish you luck. Union strong, sister. Union strong.
Union strong.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bob Rossi, with an excerpt from a recent labor segment on the Willamette Wake Up program airing on Salem, Oregon's KMUZ. Hey, thanks for listening to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. We hope you've enjoyed these highlights from Labor Radio and podcast shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local labor radio show.